Hi, I'm Chuck. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I want to thank my friend Lee for inviting me, and Mike for my host. My friend Roger's here, too. I haven't seen Roger in a long time, about 6 years. Roger and I go way back, probably about 2000? Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it's good to be here. If you're new, welcome to AA. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad you're here. And he was right. The only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stay sober. That's it. Desire to not drink. That's it. That's it. Real simple to be here. Not a lot. Not a lot. Although the price tag's pretty heavy. By the time I get here, I'm beat up. It's not good. It's not going good. And if you're new, I can probably just guess it's been a bad year. Nobody comes in here on a roll. Just won the lottery, having sex with twins. This is great. I want to hang out with you guys. Not gonna happen. Long drive. I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have spokesmen for Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been asked to come here and share my experience with AA here and what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. And I'm supposed to, in a brief description, tell you how I formed a relationship with a power greater than myself, which has relieved the obsession to drink and enabled me to live happily and usefully whole. That's what it says in the 12 and 12, and that's been my experience. Long drive up. I want to thank my wife for letting me do that. She kind of gets a little. My cats get really upset when I leave all day and take off someplace. Ironically, and I just got back from travel, so I've been gone a lot. But I'm delighted to be here. I'm not a speaker. I'm not ordained. There's nothing special about me at all. What I am is a puking drunk from a place called Tulare, California. Do you guys know where that's at? You can smell it before you get to it. Yeah, I live in Burbank now. I've lived in Los Angeles for a lot of years, but I grew up in Tulare. I'm just a fallen down drunk, garden variety drunk. That's what I am. And dying of alcoholism when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been separated from alcohol in any form at all since June the 14th of 1993. And I'm grateful for that. I've had many sobriety dates prior to that. Anybody else? Yeah. I remember I went to a clubhouse where a dude, he tattooed. This is before tattoos were like the thing, you know? This is when like women wore earrings and guys had tattoos back then. And he tattooed his sobriety date on his arm, and then he had to keep covering it up. That's my guy. So if you've been here before, if you're coming back, I want to welcome you home to Alcoholics. Welcome back to AA. If you're new, welcome home. We're glad you're here. And we mean that. We really mean that. And I was perplexed for a lot of years because you would always say, welcome home, welcome back. And I used to wonder, what's the angle? What do you want from me? I got nothing, but what do you want? And I kind of confused for a long, long time. And then I was someplace and I heard a guy tell a story. And I just thought, man, that makes a lot of sense. And it's about a place called Monterey, California. And it's a bay. And in Monterey, they have they have a lot of wildlife there, like you guys do here. But they have pelicans there that are pretty popular there, like a certain breed of pelican. And the pelicans were all over the place. And what they used to do was the fishing companies would gut the fish, throw the guts into the water, and then can the fish and sell the fish. And the pelicans started eating the fish guts out of the water, and they became overweight. They became very complacent. No, I'm not judging anyone. they were just okay, just doing, you know, the bare minimum. And they didn't have to hunt. They didn't have to fish, everything. And one day the vitamin companies came in, and they made a deal with the companies to take all the fish guts and use some of them to make vitamins and such. And overnight, they stopped throwing the guts out into the water. And what happened was the pelicans started starving. You'd go through Monterey, and you'd see these tweaker pelicans, you know, walking around, you know. And it got serious. They were afraid because they were dying off. They didn't know what to do. And the city council got together, and they got a plan going, and what they were going to do is bring in a bunch of baby pelicans and just write the old ones off because they weren't going to make it. Just get a whole new thing going. And this is what happened. What happened is they brought the new baby pelicans in, and the baby pelicans instinctively knew where to fish and how to fish. And the ones who'd been around a while that forgot learned how. By watching the baby pelicans. So newcomers, oftentimes you're the inspiration for me to do what I don't want to do, what I stop doing or I'm slacking off on doing somehow, some way. I'm the kind of alcoholic. I'm a self-centered, selfish guy. But the thing is sometimes I don't think very good of myself. Everything can be going really well in my life and my head will get on me and start the chatter. And I get lost in that. I get caught up in it and I start to think what I won't do for me, what I don't feel like I'm worth, I somehow will do for someone else by just trying to be helpful. I don't know how that works and I get better in doing it. And there's a line in the back of the book that I think is kind of cool. There's a doctor in 1946 that NBC sent to some AA meetings, because AA was rather new. It was, what, 10, 9 years old? 46. Yeah, 11 years old. 11 years old. And it was a new movement, and they sent this doctor to go to a few meetings to come back to NBC and talk about what he saw there. And what he said is a trip. He says, I'm going to paraphrase and butcher it up. Lee probably knows it verbatim, but he said, Alcoholics Anonymous are not a temperance society. They're not crusaders. They help others with some of their problems. And in this environment, they overcome their excessive concentration on themselves. And they remain sober the days that up to months, weeks, months, and years. And I mean, a couple of meetings, this guy got selfish and self-centered. He nailed it. I just thought that was ironic that he saw it that quickly. And I have alcoholism. I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor told me on day one I was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I didn't like that term. I'd heard that a lot in AA, and I never really knew what that meant, because that, to me, that signifies a guy like laying on the road. He's begging in front of a store. Not that I didn't do that, but I always see that I'm not so bad as some people. And the word hopeless to me, what I've really come to understand it as in Alcoholics Anonymous is this, if you're new. I desperately want to stop, and I cannot stay stopped. I desperately want to stop, and I cannot stay. That's hopeless. And I'm of the hopeless variety. I have this thing. I don't know where in the heck I got it. I've been to a lot of discussion meetings. My friend Larry calls them Oprah Winfrey meetings, where everyone just talks about their problems. And I mean, I'm not putting them down if there's a subject to talk about, but you know, we're here for the primary purpose of carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to people who are suffering. And he said that these Oprah Winfrey meetings, you hear people talk about, you know, where they got alcoholism. My wife had it. My mom had it. My brother had it. My uncle had it. It was passed down to me. And it really doesn't matter if you're here and you're new. Billy says it best. Billy's out of Vegas, and he's a self-proclaimed redneck. That's what he calls himself. And Billy says it like this. Billy says, it don't matter how the jackass got in the ditch, boy. Let's just get him out. And that's pretty much it. I have this thing. I can tell you growing up, I was the oldest of three. I have hardworking parents. My mom and dad were very poor growing up. My father, mother and father worked like farm labor, their families and stuff when they were young. They were very, very poor. We're talking 1950s poor, not modern standard today, much different. My father educated himself. He went into the military. My mom, I went back to school and worked for the school system. And everything that my mom and dad did not have growing up, every opportunity was given to me. And it's not enough. You can't love me enough. You can't give me enough. I have this sense of entitlement that the world owes me, that you're not doing it right. And I'm the oldest of three. I'm going to school. I don't fit in well. I'm nervous at school. My stomach hurts. I don't like the other kids. I'm not smart. I'm not good in school. I'm not sociable. We don't have a lot of money, so I'm not with the hip kids. And I don't know how to play sports. I don't play sport. I don't get sports this day. I don't even get it at all. I'm more like a Iron Maiden, Judas Priest kind of guy. You know, that's my crowd. And what happened for me is I started hanging around an elite crowd early in school called stoners. A couple of them here. And They're always in the room. And they were easy to get along with. They were, you know, you just hang out with them, steal stuff, light fires, smoke cigarettes. And I had never been under the influence of anything, but I acted loaded because it was cool. And it's pathetic, really it is, isn't it? And I was kicked out of junior high for having a roach clip on a necklace. I never even used it, and I got kicked out of junior high for that. But when I was 13 years old, I went to this junior high school, and it was a room like this. It was called the multipurpose room. They had lunch there, they had plays there, assemblies, and then the tables would fold into the wall. And on Friday, they would pull out a record player. Remember those? Records. They put records on, and the kids would dance in there at lunchtime. They had these noon dances, and I would always, like, on Thursday, be planning out who the lucky girl was going to be. And then during the dance, I never had the guts. Man, I just stood against the wall, terrified, trembling, you know. And I'd watch everyone else do it, and I would just stand there. And I'd walk back to class, and I'd have that feeling in my gut of being a loser, of being afraid, of not being able to tell anyone how I felt. I was at a wedding at an AmVets hall in beautiful downtown Pixley, California. And I was 13 years old. Our neighbors were getting married. We went to this hall. There were like a live band there. There was a bunch of kids from school there, a lot of parents. And I walked in the room and was uncomfortable. And I looked on the table and I saw what was on the table. And what they had was cold duck. That was the champagne at this fine event. And red wine. And I knew that if I got some of that in me, that I knew something was going to happen. And I don't have the story of an alcoholic father. I didn't experience that growing up. What I have is I have a bunch of uncles that would come over and visit us. And if they came by the house in the daytime, they were stoic. Like when you talk to them, there was never a conversation. It was like, yes, no. And they didn't have any personality at all. But if they came over at night, they'd smell like booze, and they were interested in me. They would tell me stories. They were Mexican, so they would sing a lot, you know, loud, and really their faces were red. They looked alive when they were drinking, and I knew that booze did that. So I walked over to that table, and I took a glass of champagne, or there was cold duck, and took a sip, and it was sweet and cold. It didn't taste good. And some red wine, and I didn't like the flavor at all, but I got about two in me. And somewhere in the second glass, it started to happen for me. If you're an alcoholic of my type, you know what I'm talking about. Like one minute I'm terrified, I don't fit in the room, I don't belong here, I'm not enough. And just a couple of minutes later, like my shoulders dropped, I took out a real deep breath, and I got this feeling, and not a thought, it was a feeling from Wade in here that just said, it was kind of like this feeling of, this is going to be okay. This is going to be good. This is going to be good. And that's my experience. I'm the type of alcoholic that'll walk into a room of people. I don't know anybody. I don't mix well. Or it's a work event. I don't like that guy. He's a brown nose and she's this. And I start building cases against everybody. And you start serving drinks. And 20 minutes later, I love you, man. I'm hugging on you. Give me some cocaine. We'll start a business together, you know. I connect. My sponsor, my second sponsor, you know Bob, he said something that I thought was really cool. He said to me, he goes, you know what happened that first time you got drunk? I said, well, Bob, I got drunk. He said, no, you know what probably happened for the first time in your life? I said, well, what's that? He said, that was probably the first time up to that point in your life that you were effectively relieved of the bondage of self. Everything that bothers me, just by the wayside, I can come out and play. I can be here right now with you in this moment. I live one day at a time when I'm drinking. I don't care about nothing except what's going on right now. I could be low on money and not have the rent, being scared about the landlord's going to kick me out, walk into a bar and I'm worried, bite my nails, have a couple of drinks, and I'm buying rounds 5 minutes later. Who cares? Alcohol does that. Alcohol changes the entire way I view stuff. It makes it all okay. It makes the big hurt go away, and it makes me not care. And if you're someone like me that walks around trapped in his head, a victim of his own mind, the author of his own misery, and alcohol takes that away, it's a good deal. And the first time I got drunk, I got really, really drunk. I went home, laid on the bed with one leg off. You know why? Woke up thrown up everywhere, thirsty. Couldn't wait to do that again. If that's the price, sign me up. And, you know, at the age of 13, it's not easy to drink with abandon. It's not easy. I looked really young for a long time. But I drank every chance I got. I used to get these bikers, and they would buy us, we'd give them money, and they'd buy us cases of Michelob and Southern Comfort, these Harley guys, and drank whenever I could, had a good time drinking. I'm the kind of guy that if we're going to go out and cruise around, I remember I got arrested in Pismo Beach one time, and I remember driving, I used to cruise up and down in Santa Maria. There was a boulevard by a mall somewhere. Remember that? I was up here drinking and driving around cruising. But if I'm the kind of guy, we're going to go cruising tonight, if we don't get any booze by like 8 o'clock, let's just go home. What's the point? And so I started drinking a lot. I'm having a good time. At the age of 15, I got arrested at a county fair for being under the influence and possession. I was carrying a pail, a chrome pail of Olympia beer. Remember that? It's the water. That was the slogan, yeah. And I'm walking around, I'm drinking this beer, and I'm, you know, I feel like an adult and everything. And these cops saw me, and next thing you know, I'm arrested, and I'm in court, and I got sent to AA for the first time at 15. I was just before I turned 16 years old. And I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got sent there. They gave me a card to sign. I went to this place. It was a troubled youth hut behind a Taco Bell in Tulare, California. That's where the meeting was at. And I remember showing up there. My mom dropped me off. And I walked up the stairs, and there was a dude at the door, and he goes, "Hi, I'm Ringo. I'm an alcoholic." And I thought, dude, keep it down, man. So I'm going to see me walking in here. And I walked in and sat down. I know now he was a greeter. He was doing his service commitment. And I sat down, and there was about 8 people in the room. The furniture didn't match. They didn't match. It just looked weird. It looked like a bunch of guys in bib overhauls that just got off the farm somewhere. It looked like a hayride for inbreds is what it looked like, you know. Just and I sat in the chair, and they started reading stuff, and I'm listening, and I heard God, 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 and I thought, this is church. Are they kidding? They'll probably pass a basket, and then you did. And then this woman got up and sat down in front of the table, and she started telling her story. And she said she was an alcoholic, a heroin addict, she was a prostitute. And she starts telling this blow-by-blow story, and I'm like, whoa. And then she says, "I'm here to give back to the ANA for my life. I just got paroled out of the penitentiary." And then she told her crime. She came home on a Wednesday night and poured herself some vodka, and in a blackout, her 2-year-old son drowned in the bathtub. And I went, "Oh my God, they're worse than they look." And if you're new, what started to happen at that point was I started to do something that I'm not really that qualified to do in the grips of alcoholism. And that's that I started to think. And in our literature, Wilson uses this curious line where he says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. That's bad news. Alabama used to say, remember Alabama? She used to walk up to newcomer girls and take her knuckle and hit him on the forehead and go, "You see that, honey? It don't work." And if you think about it, I have a mind that'll rationalize and justify anything I want to do, right? I just come up with stuff and I just make it okay in my head. I have a mind that offers me solutions that are worse than my initial problems. Do you identify with that? I was too drunk to walk, so I... That's the mind. My favorite was this dude gave a talk one time, and he said, "I was drinking vodka every night, and I was vomiting blood in the middle of the night, and I was horrified by it. So I put tomato juice in the vodka." That's my guy. So I have this mind. It's just, and what happened for me at that moment, as I started thinking, and this is what happened. The voice in my head started to talk. Anybody hear a voice in their head? It just said, "What voice?" That's the voice. It said, "Dude, you're not an alcoholic. You're not like these people. They need this thing. Your problem isn't drinking. Your problem is you got caught." That's the problem. And how would you tell a 15 and a half year old kid who doesn't mix well, doesn't get along well, that can't go to a party and hang out, "But if you give me booze, man, I'm talking to cheerleaders, the jocks of my friends, I'll get on the stage with the band, I'm just come alive." How can you tell me that's my problem? You're bad-mouthing the only thing I know that works. And I'm thinking to myself, it's not the problem. The solution, here it comes. The solution is I should do things that are more concealable than booze. It's a bust. So I started smoking a lot of non-addictive marijuana. Anybody else smoke some marijuana? A lot of it? Yeah. And this one guy, one time I said that, he came up and he goes, dude, I smoked a lot of pot. I go, cool. He said, no, man, I smoked a lot. I go, okay, bro, how much do you smoke? He said, I smoked so much pot, the zigzag man had a tattoo of me on his arm. I said, that's a lot of pot. That's a lot of pot. And I started taking these, I was taking these crosstops. Remember those little pills with the X's on them, the little white ones? Go fast. Yeah. Take like four of those, drink a quart of beer, wash your car 3 or 4 times. Real excited, get a lot done that day. You know? This is the time I call BT before tweak. Are there tweakers here? Hands up. Come on, let's see them. I knew it. My friend said, if you're driving up there to Santa Maria, them ain't chimneys, them's meth labs. welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're a drug addict, if you're a junkie, if you're a doubt out, welcome to AA. Just catch the drought disease, the dread disease, alcoholism. Just catch alcoholism. The tweakers are they're a funny breed. They're fast. I like to catch them when they're doing it and go, did you see that, bro? Go home and dissect the toaster, you know, shop all night at Walmart, stay up for 2 weeks playing video games. It's just funny. I make fun of you guys. I'm making fun of you. I'm getting close, though. All right. I bring that up for a reason. I mean, I don't mean to trash the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm truly an alcoholic. That's what I really am. When I look at my relationship with alcohol, I see where it all starts and where it all ends. But I'm the kind of guy that if you put stuff in front of me, I usually don't ask questions. And number one. Number two is when I was young, they never asked for an ID. They never asked me for an ID. So it was just easy, and I did a lot of that. I bring it up for another reason, too. I bring it up because for years and years, I would come to meetings, and I didn't know where I belonged. And later on, I would read this beautiful book that was written in 1937-39 by a bunch of guys from Akron, Ohio, of all places, 25, 30 years before I was born, and they knew I was coming because they described me. And my friend says it best, while I read that, I should ask myself some questions. Do I feel like they feel? Do I do what they do? Do I drink like they drink? And when I did that, I went, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. I also bring this up because I know there's a lot of people who come to AA that don't know where they belong. And well-intentioned old-timers are often very rude to them. And these are kids. These are our sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, grandsons, nieces and nephews that are dying of an illness. And no one's saying, hey, we should interview and find out what you are before we pass you on to another fellowship where you might get some help as well. Because we have friends there. They're our friends. And anyway, enough of that soapbox. Pardon me. So I'm doing all these combinations of goodies. At the age of 18 years old, my girlfriend comes to me and says those three words you do not want to hear if you're a young man. I'm pregnant. Yes. I am pregnant. Not good. So I did the right thing. I married my girlfriend. I was 18 years old. I went to work. I did two jobs. And at 19, I bought my first home in Tulare, which blows my mind. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath home. And my daughter was born and welcomed into a loving, loving home. She had one toy room down the hall and her bedroom on the other end. It was decorated nicely. Our lawn was manicured. We had two new cars in the garage. Police officer across the street, barbecues on our block, and I'm slowing down, I'm chipping the drinking, and I want to be a good father, and I want to move up in the company, and I want to raise my daughter and be her hero, and alcoholism doesn't care. Doesn't care what I want to do, doesn't care who I love, doesn't care what's meaningful in my life, it must be treated, and I had no clue. If you're new tonight, I have some really bad news for you. Alcoholism must be treated. There is no not treating alcoholism. One thing I will not do is not treat my illness. I will either treat it with alcohol or a substance, or I'll treat it with a spiritual way of life. There is no middle of the road. I wish there was sometimes. It's not there. I've looked for it. I've talked to a lot of people. I've never seen it. And I didn't know any better, so I'm smoking a lot of pot, drinking. I'm keeping it together. And about 3 years into the marriage, my wife couldn't take it anymore, and she walked out. She just got tired of it. My behavior was bad. I mean, I work a lot, but if I'm not at work, I'm on the couch loaded. And she leaves, and when she leaves, the wheels fall off. There's no one there to slow me down, and now I'm drinking hard liquor. I'm up really late at night, and at this time, I'm working for a company that sent me to my first rehab. I was 22 years old, called Anheuser-Busch. And they sent me to my first rehab at the age of 22 years old up in Fresno near Clovis. It was called the ARC, the Alcohol Recovery Center. And they sent me there for 30 days. They detoxed me off everything. This place, you could not have coffee. You couldn't have cigarettes. It was a detox, man. You were dried out. You catch on fire, you were so dry. And I went there for 30 days. I'm in there. They had AA coming in, panels coming in, meetings coming in. I want nothing to do with any of it. And what I want to do is go back to work, you know, get a new girlfriend, get a new car, and move on with my life. And I walked out of that rehab on a Friday night, convinced I would never, ever drink again. After being, to me, incarcerated for 30 days in this place. Roger's laughing at me. and I'm never going to drink again. If you had put me on a lie detector and asked me, it would have said I was telling the truth. And about 4 hours after being out of that place, I walked directly into a liquor store and bought a suitcase of Budweiser. And I started the run. And within, our book says that this is a progressive illness, which means it gets worse, never better. Here's the bad news. The bad news is, as I sit in here not drinking, abstaining from drinking, thank you, my illness is getting worse. And I'm going to explain how that meant, what that means to me. I was in there for 30 days, and when I took a drink after I left, the wheels fell off. I could not stop. And within 4 months of being out of that treatment center, I had lost everything I had ever owned. Everything I had ever owned was gone. And I went where the tough guys in the world go, Mama's couch. And I'm on that couch, and I can't get off it, and every day's the same, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and every day by 11 or 1 o'clock, I got to do something, take something, drink something to get it off me. And at that time, I'm unemployable, and I'd been to a lot of meetings, and I heard the behavior people would talk about, and I'd think, I'm not like that, you don't get it. I'm a hardworking guy, I don't steal from people, I'm not scandalous, but as the days go by, I got to survive, and I start doing those things one at a time, those yets. And I'm stealing from my parents. I'm taking money from their out of their checking accounts, and they're taking their stuff to pawn shop, and I don't like myself for it. And I hate the excuses I have to. I hate watching my mom walk into a store to buy back the checks that I wrote to her friends. It's a small town. She knows these, and she's making up excuses. And my father, you know, going and buying back his jewelry and his tools and things. And I never pawned anything with the intention of not getting it out. I always had the intention, I'm going to get it out. And the one that's killing me is I have a daughter who's 3.5, 4 years old. And her mom brings over to my where I live, at grandma's house on the weekends for daddy-daughter weekends. And what happens is she gets there on a Friday night, and I'm gone. And Saturday rolls around, and she's there all day waiting in the front window because Grandma, he promised this time. And Saturday rolls off, and they try to get her to go to the movies or the shopping center, and she doesn't want to go because I might come. And sometime Sunday, a couple hours before her mom gets back, I beg my mom for the car keys and $5, and I run to McDonald's, and I buy her a Happy Meal and tell her how next week it's going to be different. Next week we're going to go to Chuck E. Cheese, or we're going to go to the zoo. And next week's always next week, and it's always next week, and it's always next week. And she looks up to me with those little innocent eyes and says, I know, Daddy, you were busy. And if you live like that long enough, if I know I can't even make it to see my daughter, I hate myself, and I get suicidal. I remember one time my dad walked into a room and he said, you know, if you're going to kill yourself, do me a favor. Would you go somewhere else and do it? I don't want your mom to see it. You know, my dad adored me when I was a kid. You know, what makes a father turn like that on a child? Alcoholism. The spiritual tapeworm. The cancer of the soul. And a buddy of mine had moved to Los Angeles. He was doing really well. He was going to UCLA. And I got this idea in my head. If you're new and you have a plan, we want to hear it. It's probably a doozy. This was my plan. My plan was this. I'll move to Los Angeles and get away from alcohol and drugs forever. It was a good plan. So I packed up the car. I moved to LA. I'm going to tell you the other reason why I left. Because my sponsor told me to cut my hair, shave somewhat, iron my shirt and put on a coat and a tie and come here and try to be an example is what he told me to do. And you might get the impression and think I'm a nicer person than I really am. So I'm going to tell you the other reason why I left. It's important. I was dating a girl and she was pregnant. And she was starting to get prenatal money, GR. And when she got that money, we would cash it and I would spend it all. And I got this idea that I'll just disappear. I'll just forget all about this and go away and forget it ever happened. And that was my plan. So I moved to Los Angeles. I went to work for these guys in Santa Monica, making a lot of money. They want these bodybuilders. And what happened was this weird thing where all of a sudden I wasn't off the rails for a while. These guys were on me, and it gave me enough rope to hang myself. And I was having bad runs, but I was keeping the job, making money. And I was in this office one day in March of 88. My mother called me and said, Kelly gave birth to your son today, and which should have been the happiest day of my life. And my response to her was this, why are you doing this to me? Why can't you leave me alone? And I hung up. The ice around my heart was so cold, I just couldn't even. And I knew the truth. I can't be a dad. I don't know how to be a father. And so I forgot about it, left it alone. About 3 months later, she called me up. She said, I hate to bother you. We have a problem. Your son's in the hospital and he needs blood. Do you think you can help us? And if you're wondering about this power greater than yourself or this God, my friend Carla said something that I really agree with. And she says this, look for the times that something showed up in your life and something happened that was beyond you. And I think back on that. And I remember getting in the car, leaving work, and driving up north and going and do the right thing. Just compelled to go. And I got there and I saw my son for the first time. And he was in a hospital bed with IVs in his arm. And it was just, I stayed. I didn't leave. I didn't leave until he was released. And when he was released, I loaded her up in the car. I loaded him up in the car. And I moved to Los Angeles with me. And I lived in a place called Brentwood. If you're not familiar with Brentwood, I live in Burbank now. It's about $2.5 million down the road from Brentwood. we had this really nice, I had this really nice apartment that I was paying for. She moved in, but she's an alcoholic too, and she drinks like I do, and it's bad. The two of us are just a nightmare. I lose the job. We end up moving to the Valley. I never heard of it. There was a guy that I worked with, a mechanic, that had a spare room that he was renting out. He had car parts in the living room. The window in the bathroom was painted open with no hot water. And we took our infant son and moved into there. We had a sober living type bed, one of those real narrow beds. We're both laying on opposite ends. And my kid's laying in a laundry basket with towels. That's his bassinet, and that's our life. And we're fighting all the time. I never saw a man strike a woman, and we're punching each other, choking each other out, scratching each other, drunk, fighting in the middle of the night. I'm embarrassed to even admit that, but it's the truth. And we no longer can work, and now we're in front of Ralph's, and we're panhandling for money, and in front of Toys R Us, and that's our life. And we need to buy ice and milk for our kid. And sometimes we buy the milk, and sometimes we just get a bottle and get well, and that's how we're living. And in 91, I was arrested one more time and put up before a judge in Van Nuys Superior Court, and he was talking about, I'm not a criminal. I'm a nuisance is what I am. I got like a lot of petty crap on there, like a punk, you know. And he said, I can send you to the state penitentiary for over a year, and that scared me. I'm terrified of being locked up. I'm a small guy. I'm like an hors d'oeuvre in prison. I don't want to be in there, you know, calling some dude Papa. Not my deal. And he said, look, we can try this case or I can give you diversion. I took diversion. It was really simple. Back then in the early 90s, you pay $25, go to Saturday, these classes all day. And then in 6 months, you come back with a piece of paper and they dismiss the case entirely. It's over. Good deal. Only problem with diversion is they have a tester that I've had trouble with my whole life called the urinalysis. And I don't know how you pass that. I have no clue how anyone could ever pass a UA. Because I have to do something. But I had been to enough meetings, 12-step meetings, all the fellowships, and the common theme was this. If you're new, they're going to say this to you. Well-intentioned people will say, just don't drink no matter what. just don't drink no matter what. And telling a dude like me, just don't drink no matter what, it's like telling somebody with projectile diarrhea, wear white and don't go. That's going to get messy. I drink no matter what. If we read the literature, he says that over, this is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And then on 24, he says this thing I love. For reasons yet obscure, the alcoholic is unable at certain times to bring into his consciousness with sufficient force the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. He's without defense against the first drink. I drink no matter what. And I didn't know that. That's what powerless means. I didn't realize that for years. I thought powerless meant what I heard in meetings. I wrecked my car. I put my hands on her. I got arrested again. I lost my job. That's not powerless. That's what happens being drunk. Powerless is this. I want to stop and I can't stay stopped. I want to stop and I can't. It makes me do what I already don't want to do, including it sober. It convinces me I can do it again. It makes it safe. And I didn't know that. And I took a drink no matter what. I did 3 days off the booze. Third night, I got drunk really bad. I got arrested. And thank God, instead of taking me to jail, where I would have been really bad with that case, they took me to a psychiatric hospital. And I was 5150 and four-pointed to a bed. Anybody else ever done that before? 5150? It means you're a danger to yourself and others. And so here's what happened for me. I'm in this mental ward. I'm good being there. I'm fine. 3 meals a day, TV, snack time, music day, music afternoons. It was cool in there. And then on the third night, they came and said, hey, listen, man, you, out of about 80 people, you guys have to come to this chemical dependency meeting. And I didn't want to go, but they said, you have to go. So I walk into the cafeteria. The three of us sat down, and in comes this guy with a bunch of literature. Comes walking in, and I look over, and I see the book. And I go, oh, this is AA. This is AA. I don't want to be an AA. I hate AA. People in AA perplex me. They're always so happy and cheerful and grateful for everything. And everything's a miracle. The coffee's a miracle. I don't like it. You know, and they always come in when I'm at my worst. I'm like really bad off, and they're telling me how they bought this, they have that, they're great. And I'm thinking, yeah, great pal. I hope you die in a fiery accident in your new car going home. And I know the story anyway. You've heard it a million times. The guy was a skid row wino. He peed on himself. Nobody loved him. And he put the plug in the jug and walked through that door, and now he's running Microsoft with Bill Gates. You know that story. And this is what happened. This was a guy from something called Hospitals and Institutions. Anybody doing HNI here? Thank you. Thank you. On that night that you were too tired, that you favorite ball game was on, that you were going to have your kids, that you worked a double shift and you promised to, you had a commitment to be there to, so those people wouldn't hear you. Thank you for going, because I heard you. And he walked in, and he sat down, and he started to tell the story. And he said he was an alcoholic, and he talked about the way that he drank, and he talked about the way he felt. And he said that he was a loser his whole life. That he'd always blown everything he ever tried. That he was always afraid. That he was a coward. And he talked about the way that he treated his family and his friends. And he said, you know, I'm the worst kind of son there is. I'm a terrible kind of brother and friend. And I'm the worst kind of father you ever know. And I went, oh my God. He goes, I don't know how to be a man. And I thought, well, who told him? He described me in a way I'd never heard a human being describe me. The way he felt, the way he drank. He did stuff I'd never heard of, but those feelings, I never heard a human being talk like that. He talked about the hole in his soul you couldn't fill with anything you could touch or see, that it was an inside job. He talked about this. He talked about a God-sized hole. And I'm listening. And he starts talking about being sober in AA 5 years. And he was an accountant. And he was going to school to be an accountant. And I didn't care about that, but where he nailed me was this. He said, you know, I lost my daughter through drinking when she was little. And I used to do supervised visits. And now today I get to take her out on the weekends. And I took her to a carnival last week. And we went to this thing and got on this Ferris wheel. And we ate cotton candy. And he started to describe that. And I started crying like a baby. Because I'm sitting in a chair in a nut ward with a gown that ties in the back. And I'm talking about my kids, and I haven't seen either one of them in 2 years. I don't know where they go to school. I don't know how old. I don't know what they're doing. And I knew. And I hate myself for that. There's no drinking that away. And for some reason, when he talked, I got a little bit of hope. And the voice in my head said, hey, this guy's just like you. Maybe if you do what he's doing, maybe, just maybe, maybe you wouldn't live the way you're living, which is really step two. And after the meeting, I said, hey, what do I do? And he handed me a directory, and he said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to. I really felt like AA might do something for me. And I walked into my first meeting in Reseda at the place called the Valley Club. And I sat in the chair, and this guy got up the podium. He came strolling up. He was an old-timer. I think he got sober when the earth was still cooling. And he said, I'd like to talk to the newcomer tonight and tell you that you never have to take a drink or a drug the rest of your life if you don't want to, and even if you want to, one day at a time, living this way of life. And I went, wow. Even if I don't want to, he gets it. This dude gets it. And then another dude got up and he said, stay here and listen to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought they were going to pull out guitars and start playing the instruments. It was the laughing and the laughing and the crying. You know, laughing because they were so pathetic, and crying because they were grateful. And I got hooked. I started going to AA meetings at night. I went to meetings in the morning, meeting at night. I bought your book. I opened up to page one because that's how I read a book. And it said, here lies a Hampshire grenadier. And I closed it and said, that's Shakespeare. We're not reading that crap. I did not get any commitments. I did not get a sponsor. I don't like being told what to do by people. Not realizing when they say put your hands on the car, they're telling you what to do. I'm not going to get any jobs or commitments here, but I'm good. I'm going to meetings and I'm sober. And I did that for 6 months and 7 days, enjoying the fruits and benefits of step number none in a joyful land called sobriety. And I don't know about you, but my problem is the longer you get me away from a drink, the worse I seem to get. I get crazy. I get bipolar, right in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I start to just suffer, and I don't know what's wrong with me. It's like I'm plugging the fridge and waiting for everything to spoil. And I'm wound up. I'm wound up, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm making money, and I go on a date with this girl, and we're sitting at dinner, and the waitress screws up and puts a Bud Light on the table. I drink Bud Light, and I grab that bottle, and she said, ooh, you can't have that. You're alcoholic. I said, this is God's will. And I cracked that puppy, and I took a sip, and I had my meal, and I finished the whole bottle slowly, pushed it away, didn't order a second one, ate dessert, and I went, they lied to me. Bunch of crap, phenomenon of craving, and I didn't drink that night, but I thought about it every moment, all week. I didn't tell anybody what I did, and the next week I ordered the first one, then I ordered the second one. Somewhere in the second one, she's sitting across the table and she ain't looking right. I could do better. And I just start this whole argument fighting because I got to go get drunk. And what happened for me was I took that drink and I couldn't stop taking that drink for the next 2 years. And I kept coming to your meetings. I kept coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, hoping to God I would get sober. And I'm the guy you might know in your home group that shows up and gets 30 days and drinks, 15 days and drinks, 45 days in drinks, 60 days in drinks, over and over and over and over. And young people in AA start saying really rude, crude things, and some of the old timers do. And I don't know where I fit or where I belong, but I'm dying of alcoholism and I got nowhere to go. I start to think I don't have what you have because you seem to get sober and your life's good, and that's not my experience. As I stop drinking, it gets worse. And on June the 14th of 1993, I fell to the floor that morning and I was sick and tired. I had this sense I was dying and I couldn't stop it. And this is what really scared me, was the only thing in my life that had ever made life okay and livable that connected me to you and the world wasn't doing that anymore. I mean, I could do a lot of stuff and get really loaded, but I couldn't shut my head off anymore. It was like the stuff I hated about me was even louder when I was drinking. And I got scared. I woke up that morning and I begged this God I didn't believe in for help. And I ended up opening my wallet, and there was a card of a gentleman that I met in a meeting. He used to always be at the meeting. His name was Art Miller. God rest his soul. Happy Veterans Day. He was a retired Navy corpsman. If you're a veteran, God bless you, and thank you. He was a retired Navy corpsman, and he was a kind little old Jewish man. He was really sweet to me. I would show up rummy in the room and crying, and he would always come and give me a cup of coffee, and he would bear hug me, and he would say, welcome home, and he meant it. And he said, I don't care how you come, kid, just come.
And I just kept going to those meetings. And I called this guy up and I said, "Hey, Art, it's me, Chuck. I'm dying, man." He said, "I know. No shit." And I said, I don't want to die like this. And he said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober?" They used to ask that to us in AA. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I want you to check into this detox." And I said, "Well, except for that, I'm not going to." And I heard this dial tone in the background, you know, and I thought, you know, whoa, here's a guy that liked me and he just hung up on me. And I thought about my options. And, you know, in the book, there's a line there where it says, "Come to believe in a power greater than myself." There's something that precedes that. And this is it. "When I come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I'm living it, that's when it starts." And I was at that place. I just had no friendly direction, as Clancy says. And I picked the phone up and called him and said, "What do I do?" And he picked me up. And I weighed 126 pounds. I had really long hair. My kidneys were really screwed up from everything I was doing. And I was limping. And he got me in the car and cleaned me up. And he, on the way to the detox, he said, "You're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, kid." And I looked at him and he said, "Let me tell you what that means. You're going to die with a needle hanging out of your arm, or you're going to die choking on your own vomit in the back of some car." And he said, "When you finally do die, the people in your life that you love and respect, they're going to be relieved you're finally gone." And I thought, man, I'm having a bad day here already. You know what I mean? I didn't say it. And he said, "I've been watching you for a really long time, and I got to tell you something. You got a bad attitude, and your chances are less than average, like the book talks about." I thought, what? And he said, "The good news is, if you do twice as much, you can catch up." And I became committed to do whatever Art Miller did. And Art was a man of service. He was a P&I. He was an H&I. 3 weeks sober, they had me going to panels with them. I didn't get to talk. I'd sit in there and let them all talk. And then after a while, I got to share a little bit and say my name. And then after a while, I got to share a little bit about what I was doing in AA. And about 2 months into it, they gave me a panel. And I think three months, I got my own panel, which was against the rules, but they gave it to me. And I started taking panels into detox. I'm going to tell you something. That, I think, is the great 12-step call of our time, in my opinion, is H&I. It is where we reach out and really meet people where they're at. And I've been doing panels for years and years and years in L.A. County Jail, detoxes, rehabs, psych wards, penitentiary, federal penitentiary. I've met a lot of really wonderful people and had some real great relationships, and I've got to see myself. I've got to go see people that are doing the time that I didn't have to do. Because isn't it true? People like me should probably be locked up for the stuff I did. And I'd go in there and talk to these people, and I just would see myself up front, close, and personal. And I'd walk out of there with gratitude. Not that I'm getting to leave, but that you've given me something to bring in there. You've given me something to share in there, which is monumental. I did the steps with Art. He took me through the 12 and 12, which is a phenomenal book. A lot of great stuff in there. But as it says early in the preface, that it's a series of essays designed to broaden the work of the original steps, which are in our book. I wrote an inventory from some company out of Minnesota, not to be named. I started moving forward, and Art saved my life. He was a beautiful man. He helped me a lot, and I started getting better. And at about 5.5 years sobriety, I did these, I didn't do full amends. I did the ones that were going to bite me and left the rest alone because I'm doing good now. Kind of half patchy there. And Angie Dill says it best. I was trying to make chicken salad out of chicken shit is what I was trying to do. And I'm 5 years sober, and I get this job. It's white-collar crime. I don't know it when I walk in. It looks like a great job, but a few months into it, I see what's going on. And I'm making a lot of money, and I can't leave. I can't leave. Where am I going to go and make money like this? And I justify it in my head. And after a while, let me tell you something. If you've been around a while, if you're like me, if I go to meetings and I'm doing something immoral that I'm not transparent with somebody about, it gets very hard to hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because these people are talking about honesty and stuff, and I don't want to hear it. And I start judging everybody because I'm a liar and you must be too. And I almost judge myself right out of these rooms. And at 6 years sober, I'm suicidal. I want to kill. I'm no longer asking God how to help the man who is still sick. I'm asking for the guts to pull the trigger on a 9mm because AA is not working anymore. And I mean it. It's bad. And I heard a guy speak at a podium a few years back, and he lived in Las Vegas. And I ended up working in Vegas, and I followed him around for a while and asked him to sponsor me. And he took me through that book page by page. And they do a lot of stuff, his group. And I got acclimated with the big book and started learning the steps. And I wrote did the third step on my knees with this guy. It was very embarrassing, but I did it. He said, "Are you embarrassed of your God?" And I said, "Well, I am, but I'll do it, Bob." And I did the prayer, and then he had me write an inventory. A real Savior life, honest to goodness, big book inventory. I'm resentful at, what's the cause, what's the effect? Can I see how I'm like the people like me are perhaps spiritually sick or not perfect like me? Can I forgive? Can I put myself in their shoes enough to let them off the hook? And then where am I to blame? Where am I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And what are the defects of character that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? What are they? And I wrote that inventory, and then fears and the sexual inventory. And all of a sudden, what started to happen is my relationship with my father changed, with my mother changed, with my ex-wives changed. It's like the world shifted. Clancy says something. He says, "I took the steps and I didn't change, but the whole world did." And somehow it all started to shift. I remember reading that inventory to Bob and driving home on the 95 freeway in Las Vegas and looking up and seeing the lights. I'm not a fan of Las Vegas at all, but it was beautiful how lit up everything was. And I felt this freedom. I felt this like, whoa, weight was off of me. And he had me doing 6 and 7 because I was still working in that industry. And I kept praying for the defects to be removed, and I couldn't close deals, and I wasn't making money, and I was taking draws from the boss, and I couldn't see the hand of God to get me out of there. I kept scratching and trying to make things work. And then one day I was on the phone, and I heard this rumbling feet. I look up, and I have FBI agents everywhere with guns pointed at me saying, "Drop the phone." And I tell you something, that defect got removed quick. And I ended up in a federal court trial and a lot of stuff and a lot of work to clean that up. And then Bob started having me do real amends. And he said to me, he caught me balking on the amends. I was coming up with ways of not doing them in full. And he said, "Yeah, I know guys like you. I sponsor a guy like you. He's got a lot of time. And he's in and out of deals, always broke, always got problems. And up and down, because he won't do his amends, you know. But I sponsor this other guy. He's not that bright. You know, he works for a plumber assistant, gives his wife half his money, lives in a sober living, barely getting by. What's going to happen for him is he's going to become a journeyman plumber. He'll get his license. He'll build a big business and a big life, and you, my friend, will be doing what you're always doing." And I knew he was telling me the truth. And he said, "The universe is the greatest accountant that there is, and as long as you owe, kid, you will always owe. And if you put back, you will become open to receive all of God's gifts." And I knew he was telling me the truth. And I started paying back money and doing the things that I didn't like doing. And I found it took me, I was 15 years sober before the money was paid off. And the reason why is because I played around and didn't do it earlier. And it got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I share that with people because I tell you, it's a lot easier to face it and just do it than to try to run from it. It just grows and grows. And I started doing that stuff and then 10 and 11. And then all of a sudden my life shifted and I was sponsoring a lot of people and started a home group, and my life started changing. It's been a good go. I'm with the same woman. I've been with her for 26 years now. I'm 24 years sober. She saw the worst of it. We stayed together. Got a good marriage. Got a little home, business, a small business. Work with a lot of guys, you know, and active home group. My life's full. I got a good life today, and it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I own should have a stamp on the back, property of AA. And somebody at a conference gave me a shot glass. They gave me a shot glass, and it says on the shot glass, "Everything I own fits in this glass." And that is the truth. That is the truth. You've introduced me to a God of my own understanding here. It's changed. It's developed over different ways. And it's really the smile on your face, the look in your eye, the kindness in your heart when I see you helping someone else. And when I see newcomers change, the 12th step, the greatest show, the ringside seat to the greatest show on earth. To watch people recover, to watch them come back to life, to watch your kids come back, to watch them go back to parents. I've saw that over and over and over again. Our home group has just suffered. We had a young man, I sponsored him for 9 months, and he died in June. He overdosed, which was just sad. And then we had another guy with 4 years. Lee met him. He was killed hit by a car last month. And then one of the women in our group for a long time just died in her sleep last Wednesday, and we're hurting, and we suit up and show up, and we have these memorials and celebrate people's lives and put our hand behind the new guy and grab another new person and bring him in and keep going and keep their memory alive. And what's weird is to see all the people that when Dorothy passed away, to see all the people that she affected. It was this ripple that was huge, to affect that many lives, to be that connected to something. And if you're new, I'm going to tell you something. If they take a picture of this crowd, you're in it. You're part of it. You're part of this thing. So we want to embrace you. We want you to come here, take these steps and these actions and have the experience you're going to have, and then come back and share it with us and tell us what you got. I live a full life today. I'm a guy with a... I dropped out of high school, never went to college, never did anything right my entire life, but you taught me to suit up, show up, do what I'm going to say I'm going to do when I say I'm going to do it, and that has worked real, real well for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has just changed me. It's an awesome program, and if you're new, we want you to stay. We want you to come here and put your hand in and give us a hand doing this thing and grab some people behind you, because that's really what, to me, that's the best time of doing the steps is taking somebody else to the steps. And there's an old Hindu proverb that is, it says this. You heard the one that says, when the student's ready, the teacher appears. My experience has been the student doesn't learn the lesson until he teaches it, straight up. I get more out of showing people, trying to be an example and show people what we're doing here than I've ever got doing it on my own. And that's the magic of AA. So I want to thank you for having me tonight. God bless you guys. Good luck to you. It was wonderful to be here. I love you, Lee.